Ever try to get into one of Advertising Week's amazing sessions and suddenly hear that the room is at capacity? Now you can still experience it in real time. Listen to that keynote or panel as a live audio stream in the Advertising Week app, powered by Live365. Advertising Week Radio features sessions, podcast clips, curated music, and more, both during the shows and year-round. Visit aw.live365.com for easy access instructions. Live365, the world's audio.
Welcome to Great Minds, and in 5 years of recording, Chuck, I don't know that I've ever been as excited as I am for today's episode with you. And we've had some wonderful people from the business world and the world of popular culture, but none, I think, Chuck, that have really struck my chord. I would say tickled my ivories, Chuck, but we just met, and that sounds a little bawdy, so I don't know if I should say that. But with us today is Chuck Lavelle. Chuck is not only one of the greatest rock and roll pianist, Chuck? How do you say it?
Either way works for me, man.
Piano player, but he divides his time in the most interesting way between an incredible music career, which is very much ongoing, unbelievable work to protect our forests, and his family. And I can't think of a better way to be known than those three things: music, forest, and family. And we're thrilled to welcome you. So welcome to Chuck Lavelle.
Thank you so much, Matt. It's truly an honor to be with you, my friend. And I think you've got a great podcast going. I know you've had some really important and interesting characters, and I'm very honored to be amongst those.
Well, the honor is all ours. So, Chuck, we came to each other through the Mother Nature Network, which you founded or co-founded, geez, about 15 years ago. But I want to go back before we talk about that and talk about someone that we both know him much better than I, but I went to Emory in Atlanta, and at that time, former President Carter was just starting the Carter Center in Georgia, had an affiliation with Emory, and when I was 19, 41 years ago, I got a chance to interview him and spend time with President Carter. And I know you have a big event coming up at the Fox Theater in September to honor him. I think he'll turn 100.
He turns 100 on October the 1st. Our event is actually a little bit before that, in September on the 17th. And you are correct, it's at the fabulous Fox Theater. And I am just so pleased to be a part of it.
It is fabulous. And I think at the time when I was spending some time with him, you, as part of the Almonds, were helping get him elected as president.
We did. This would have been back in the 70s, of course. The way this happened was that we were recording Dickie Betts' first solo record, which was called Highway Call, and Carter was governor at the time. And so we get the word through management that the governor would like to come to the studio. And, you know, I mean, we figured, all right, there's a photo op and handshakes, and that'll be about it. But he came down, he was genuinely interested in the process of recording. He was genuinely interested in the music business. He asked fabulous questions. It blew our minds that he was so engaged. And then as time went on and he decided to run for president, he had befriended Phil Walden, who of course was the band's manager, the Allman Brothers band manager, and also the owner and founder of Capricorn Records. And so Phil came to us and said, listen, Jimmy Carter's going to run for the presidency. And this was the first year that they had the matching funds so that, you know, if we raised X amount of dollars, the government would match that money. And so we did several concerts for Carter, and lo and behold, it worked and he got elected. We were just so proud to have him as president.
Yeah, I hope over time that history takes a better view of his presidency. I think his heart was in the right place. He was an honorable, honest man who really, really did a lot of great stuff that I think it became popular, especially by the other side, to sort of beat on him. But I thought he did more as a president and certainly did more after his presidency than any other U.S. president has ever done.
Absolutely. And, you know, it was really, it was the Iranian hostage crisis that caused the downfall. And, oh, man, you know, everything that could go wrong did go wrong. We remember the story, the helicopters, one helicopter went down and there was a sandstorm and it just did not work. And it was just such a shame because, look, I feel like America wanted to take a chance, try to get those hostages out of there. They had been in there for a long time. Negotiations were not working. So action had to be taken. And it was just such a shame the way it went down. I think if that had not happened or if it had gone well and we'd rescued them, there's no doubt in my mind he would have had a second term and it would have been a great second term.
Yeah, I think you're right. So excited about that event at the Fox, and it is the Fabulous Fox, one of the great, great theaters in this country. I think the Fox in Detroit is kind of similar, but the Atlanta one I know quite well.
Yes, there is a great one in Detroit, and I have been there. It's pretty much equally as fabulous, although I'm a little prejudiced because I think Atlanta and Georgia has the best, but it's a wonderful venue. It's so much fun to play in there. And we have a variety of artists coming in to do this. Warren Treaty's going to be there. My friend Eric Church and many others. We're very excited to celebrate. And what an amazing thing for Carter to, and of course, we hope he makes it all the way to October 1st. But he's still with us, thankfully, and we sure hope to make it a very special birthday celebration.
That's fantastic. All right, so let's jump to the film, which is where I came to know the parts of the Chuck Lavelle story I did not know. It was an award-winning film, won a number of festival awards, I think Sedona and others, from 2020, The Tree Man. And I'd love to start our conversation by talking about the Charlene Plantation. I thought the story in the film of how you met your beautiful, lovely bride of so many years at Capricorn, Rose Lane White, was just so, what a great, great, wonderful story that is in that crazy asylum that was Capricorn Records. But I'd love to start by talking about the plantation and how it all came together. I think it was an inheritance on your wife's side.
Well, that's right. When people ask me, how did you get into these issues of conservation, forestry, the environment, et cetera, I always say it's my wife's fault. And the way it turned out was that when we decided to get married, Rosalind said to me, Chuck, you got to come meet my family. And I said, you know, you never told me about your family. And she said, well, you'll see. They're not far away. So we were in Macon and Twiggs County, was 20-25 minute drive. So we meet the family and it's kind of funny, Matt, because, you know, here's the long haired hippie boy musician playing in a rock band going out to meet the father of, you know, my potential wife to be, who was a farmer. And so you can imagine the difference in cultures there. But the truth is, they welcomed me with open arms. Then the process began of me learning about what they did. You know, they were stewards of the land. They had a farming operation. They had row crops, cotton, corn, soybeans, that kind of thing. They had some livestock as well. They had some cows and pigs. And they also had forestry scattered throughout the land that they looked after. And so we would spend time with the family on weekends. We'd go out there and holidays, and they would school me a little bit, you know, on the process of how they did what they did. And then fast forward, of course, this would have been in the 70s. We were married in 73. So 73, 74, 75, I'm with the Allman Brothers, and we're going out there to see the family occasionally. And so fast forward to 1981, Rose Lane's grandmother passes away. Of course, we went through the period of losing a loved one and the grief and all of that with the family. And by the way, Miss Julia, as she was known, Julia White, was just an elegant, elegant woman. And Rose Lane took after her grandmother a great deal. She had a great style and presence and whatnot. So all of a sudden we wake up, and now it's our responsibility, since Rose Lane has inherited about 1,000 acres, to carry on what we saw as a heritage of stewardship. Now, I'm wanting to stay a rock and roll musician. I don't want to give that up, but I wanted to do the right thing. I wasn't sure what the right thing was, so I went on a little journey of studying. I went to the library and checked out books on land use and such. I realized fairly quickly that row cropping, cattle farming, that kind of thing was a lot of day-to-day work, and I would either have to hire someone or quit being a musician, and I didn't want to do either. But forestry kept sort of coming around in my head, and I guess one connection was, hey, where does that thing that has given me so much joy and such a great career come from, the resource of wood, and where do most musical instruments come from? If not all, at least in large part, from the resource of wood. Now, that's not to say that, you know, I wanted to grow trees that would be used to make pianos or guitars or violins, but it was in my head, it was a way of giving back and to study forestry to, and then, you know, let's talk about some of the other things that trees and forests do for us. You know, they make materials to build our homes, schools, churches, offices, packaging materials, books, magazines, newspaper, you know, home and habitat for all manner of wildlife. They sequester carbon, clean air, clean water. And so the more I studied and the more I learned, the more fascinated I became with the art and the process of forestry.
And this becomes not just something that's a little research project, but you elevate yourself and you and Rose Lane together. Georgia Tree Farmer of the Year, National Tree Farmer of the Year, author of books. I remember a particular Forever Green, The History and Hope of the American Forest. And you've become an incredible advocate, testifying in Washington and Congress, getting laws passed. This became a passion and a level of accomplishment on a par with what you did way back when, you know, going all the way back to Brothers and Sisters and Jessica. Did you ever imagine when Rose Lane's grandmother passed, and I imagine it was just a curiosity, that it would become what it has, Chuck?
No idea whatsoever. I just, again, my goal was to do the right thing by the land. You know, if we can try to constantly improve the land, then it's going to always be there for us, you know. And so, again, it was a journey of study, of learning. I eventually enrolled in a correspondence course in the early 80s. I was traveling with the Fabulous Thunderbirds. Do you remember the Fabulous Thunderbirds?
Yeah, of course. Of course. Yeah.
Ain't that tough enough?
Yeah, sure. Sure.
So I spent like a year and a half working with those guys. We were traveling by bus, and I would do the homework in the bus or in the occasional hotel room that we might have. And not that it's the equivalent of going to a four-year school by any means, but it did give me a lot of information that was extremely helpful. But even more than that, it was going to other people that own tree farms that had the same passion, talking to them, learning from them. There were actually good information from government sources, what's now known as the NRCS, the Natural Resource Conservation Service. They have programs and, you know, field days and such that teach you about forestry and about other aspects of agriculture. But all of that was fantastic information. And then it was a matter of implementing that information. And so we began to manage the forest. We began to plant some areas that were former cropland. You know, we learned certain techniques. You recall in the film about prescribed burns that are a wonderful tool for a landowner to use. Of course, you have to be extremely careful and you have to know what you're doing and you don't want to have wildfires get out on you. But prescribed burns are very useful. But, you know, I just absolutely love being in the woods. You mentioned the passion word, and I'm absolutely as passionate about trees and forest and conservation as I am about music.
Tremendous stuff. I want to go back to prescribed burns in a second, but I also loved your other book about smart, strong, and sustainable growth. And widely regarded as sort of the best common sense environmental book that's ever been written, and as a layman, something that even I could understand. Chuck, talk about common sense in the environment. So much of it has gotten caught up in politics today. And it's very obvious that our planet is unhappy with us. And Mother Nature continues to tell us that in a very clear manner. Based on everything you know and continue to learn, how do we get more common sense in the conversation about sustainability, about sustainable growth? And why do you think we've gotten so far away from common sense?
Well, how have we gotten so far away? I wish I knew the answer to that one, but you're absolutely right that we need to recenter ourselves and put on the, you know, put on the right hat, the thinking cap, and start to realize what we need to be doing to, you know, be kinder to our planet. The impetus for that book was learning and thinking about population growth. You think about what the population of America is now. You may know better than me at this juncture, but 350 million or something like that. How many billions of people on the planet? And when you think back, what was the population in the 1700s, in the 1800s, right? 1900s. So we have this exponential growth and we have to accommodate it. You know, it's not going to go away. You know, you have to be realistic and realize, all right, if we're going to have that growth, how can we grow smart, strong, and sustainable? And I use examples in the book, a guy named Steve Nygren, who put together a beautiful community in the Atlanta area called Serenby. And the way they came up with the word was serenity and being. So he put this concept together because they had a little getaway in the countryside outside of Atlanta. One day he and his daughter are jogging and they see the bulldozers and he goes, oh goodness, you know, it's coming now. I can't stop it, but maybe I can guide it. So how would we guide it? What would we do? So environmentally friendly housing with proper insulation, using solar and other technology, having yards that are low maintenance, having a community market and garden and restaurants that are in the community that use the goods that are grown in that community, enough spaces between the housing where you're not so crowded and feel like somebody's right up your nose, you know. And of course, now you're seeing more electric vehicles being used. They have the golf cars available to drive around the community. And it's just a fantastic example of how you can do it right. Now, you're not going to be able to do that everywhere. And another thing for people to think about, sometimes people think, oh, my goodness, having so many people in, like, say, New York City, you know, that's a terrible thing. Well, actually, not so much, because if you have the housing and people can walk to their markets, walk to the dry cleaners, walk to their work, perhaps, as long as the buildings being built or renovated are being done so in a way that is eco-friendly, you know, that the air conditioning is going to be as low maintenance possible and still effective, so on and so forth. So that's the impetus of the book. That's what we write about. We try to show some examples and get people thinking about these issues because, you know, again, the growth is not going to stop. It's going to continue, and we just have to deal with it.
Yeah, no, so well said. Let's go back to that notion of prescribed burns, which I learned a lot from the film. I have a sister who lives in Northern California. Her town is Chico. The town next to it is Paradise. Paradise burned completely a few years ago. Bonnie had to leave her home recently because they were under threat in Chico, California. And wildfires are a problem all over, not just in California. There were severe problems, I'm sure you followed, a few years ago in Australia. Talk about prescribed burns and educate me and our audience about what that is and how that is a positive.
Well, you know, we went to Paradise. I have a television program, maybe you know about, Matt, called America's Forest. It runs on PBS. And one of the segments and one of the episodes we did was in California, and we went to Paradise. It was so graphic to see, you know, the devastation that fire caused. It was just horrible. And we actually met with a young man who barely got out with his family, a wife and two children, literally with minutes to spare his life. And he was heading up an effort for people to come back to Paradise, which was quite amazing, you know. But also along with that episode that we shot, we found some positive things that were being done. One was on some of the highways, on either side of the highway, the government, and this was under Gavin Newsom, who's still in office, of course, but they were taking what we call mulching machines, these heavy-duty mowers, if you will, and they were mowing, say, 200 feet on either side of the highway to get rid of that slash and that combustible material, so that if somebody throws a cigarette out, or if somebody, you know, a spark hits and causes the beginning of a wildfire, there's not so much vegetation there to burn from the highway. And the CAL FIRE, which is, of course, the folks that have to deal with these wildfires in California, the CAL FIRE people can get there, you know, sooner and stop the fire before it spreads and goes further and further. So that was a very positive thing. Another thing we witnessed was a community that was working with the neighbors and the surrounding areas to get people comfortable with the idea of prescribed burns and showing them, you know, taking a little section and saying, look, this is what we want to do, and this is why. We're going to cut a fire break around the area, and we're going to wait till the conditions are right. You know, you're not going to do it on a windy day when it's no humidity, but you're going to carefully prescribe, thus the word, this effort to reduce all of the vegetation that is going to cause a wildfire if you do nothing. And so things are being done, but is it enough? No. Is it soon enough? No. It needs to, and I'm not advocating that we do prescribed burns all over America by any means. There's other ways you can reduce that wildfire incident, of course. But, you know, this is a couple of ways for people to think about. And again, it goes back to the common sense.
Yeah, no, it sure does. And the PBS show, is that coming back again?
Yes, we are. Well, I'm not sure I should even say this, but we have our fingers crossed that we'll be working with the Nature Conservancy to expand the program. So we're kind of waiting to see what happens with this election right now. Get this out of the way and see who's in office, because one of our biggest supporters has been the U.S. Forest Service. And they, nor hardly any other government agency, knows what the budget's going to be now until after the election, and we see what's what. But, we hope the right people are going to be in office, that's for sure.
Yeah, no, you and me both. So let's talk about the Mother Nature Network, MNN, going back to 2009. You and Joel co-founded together. It is now the number one site in the world for people interested in the environment, interested in sustainability. You've got a couple shows in there, including a green room show, which I think is so brilliantly named, where you bring in friends of yours from the music and celebrity world to talk about the environment and sustainability. But go back to the founding and what you were hoping to accomplish, and 15 years in now, give us a state of the union on where MNN sits.
Well, to start with, the investors and the board decided, I guess it's been about 3 years now, to sell MNN to a company called Dot Dash. And we actually owned two properties at the time. We had the Mother Nature Network, MNN.com, and we had bought TreeHugger.com from the Discovery company. So we were running both websites. When we sold it to Dot Dash, they made the decision to drop in MNN, which I think was a mistake personally, and to just keep the TreeHugger.com moniker. But they are running it. It is still up there. All the content that you just mentioned is still accessible on it. But going back to the founding of it, my good friend Joel Babbitt, wonderful, brilliant, brilliant man from the Atlanta area, was in the advertising business and worked for several companies and was CEO of Gray International and out of the Atlanta office for a period of time. We became friends, and Joel called me up one day and he said, "I want you to come to my office. I want to talk to you about something." I said, "Okay." So I go in and he said, "Sit down and look at this." And he's called up every environmental website he could find. There was Grist, I think, and there were some government sites, right? But which were very, very technical and difficult to really understand. And the bottom line is, he looked at me and he said, "I can't find a website dedicated to environmentalism that makes sense, that's easy to understand, like, for instance, WebMD for health, right?" And he said, "How would you feel about joining me in this effort to build a site?" He said, "I'll resign my position. I may have to stay on for 6 months for the company to find somebody else to take my place, but I'll resign. I'll put a team together." He said, "I think I can raise the funds necessary if you'll come in with me." And I said, "Wow, okay." And we did. And boy, oh boy, it really served us so well for those years that we ran it. And I think it's still serving pretty well. Although, again, I regret that the company dropped the Mother Nature Network moniker, because I thought that was a lot more powerful and something that people could relate to. I mean, who doesn't like Mother Nature? Okay. And easier and a little less left-wing political to say Tree Hugger, you know. So we thought it was a good mainstream name. But that was the effort. I think we did well with it. I'm not sure what the viewership is these days. I'd have to look at the data to see. I stayed on as a consultant with Dot Dash for about a year and a half. And then I got busy with music and other things. And so I'm not directly associated with them anymore at this juncture.
Yeah, I agree with you. For all it takes to build a brand, and I know Joel, he was a legend in the advertising business. But for all it takes to build a brand, I always marvel when someone goes out and then kills a brand. You know, and General Motors had Pontiac and Oldsmobile, and those were pretty good brands, and they killed them. And Ford did the same with Mercury, and in the advertising business, so many great creative brands, you know, like J. Walter Thompson and others have disappeared. Young and Rubicam. It's not the way I play it.
No, well, that's right. And I think it was a mistake on Dot Dash's part. And ultimately, Dot Dash is owned by Barry Diller. And so he owns a lot of websites and a lot of those types of properties.
He does indeed. So Your discography, Chuck, is you know, we'll be here for months to go through it all. But there's one album that jumped out to me that sort of, in my simple mind, a common sense mind, if you will, builds a bridge from everything that we've been talking about to your music career. And that's the Back to the Woods album that you did, celebrating iconic blues piano players. So if you wouldn't mind, talk a little bit of music. I thought we'd start with Back to the Woods.
Fantastic. Thanks for bringing that up. You know, when people think of the blues, what is the first thing that comes to mind? Usually guitar players, okay, you know, and that's right, that's great. You know, B.B. King, Albert King, Freddie King, all the greats, Eric Clapton, contemporary players. And then they may think of honkers and shouters, the singers, you know, Howlin' Wolf, Muddy Waters, and those greats. They may think of harmonica players, right? Little Walter, that kind of thing. But rarely do people think about the piano and the role that the piano had in the development of blues music. And so my son-in-law, who is a brilliant PhD graduate from Emory University in Atlanta, and who also works at Emory now, but also does independent projects, mainly video projects, but also some music projects, came to me with this thought. And he said, you know, I think you're the guy to do this record to celebrate these characters. So, you know, Leroy Carr, great early piano player, Otis Spann, and others. And we went through a plethora of material. Steve Bransford is my son-in-law. And Steve gave me like, you know, three CD discs to listen to. And there must have been, you know, 90, 100 songs on there. And we picked through it, and I found ones that I was not only comfortable playing, but that I really enjoyed playing and had a good time. And I thought they represented the genre of blues piano quite well. And we went into the studio and we made the record. And I still enjoy playing those songs now when I do solo shows. I think it's, you know, it's a good thing to recognize the role of the piano in blues development.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic record. Was Pine Top Perkins in that mix?
Oh, gosh, yes, of course. Yeah, I got to meet Pine Top before he passed away, and that was a thrill.
Oh, boy. Yeah, I have a wonderful memory. It was late in life, and you could tell he wasn't doing great, but I did get to see John Lee Hooker in New York before he passed, and you don't forget a moment like that. So, all right, going back, I guess it was a Ray Charles concert when you were in your teens that really set you off on the path, another great piano player. And somehow you go from there and find your way to Muscle Shoals and end up playing on a gold record. But can we go back to young Chuck Lavelle and seeing Ray Charles and the impression that made on you?
Absolutely. So to begin with, my family had some Ray Charles records, and the one that stood out to me the most was Modern Sounds in Country and Western Music, that fabulous country record that Ray did. And that music just, I don't know, I just absorbed it. I thought it was so cool, so great, especially for a soul guy, you know, for R&B artist to do a country record like that back in those days in the 60s. And so what happened was I have a big sister, Judy, and Judy had a date to go see Ray Charles. My parents had another event to do, you know, that was taking them away for the evening. And they didn't really want to leave Chuck alone by himself. I think I was, you know, maybe 11, 12 years old. And so they asked Judy, well, listen, would you take Chuck? You know, and Chuck's interested in music and I'm learning the piano at the time. And she graciously, thank you, Judy, said, sure, you know, little brother can come along. So we go to the Coliseum there in Tuscaloosa. I grew up in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, Roll Tide, sorry. so we go to the Coliseum and Ray comes out with this fabulous band. And of course, he was amazing. But the band was amazing. You had Fathead Newman on saxophone. You had the Raylettes singing. Billy Preston was playing organ in the band. at the time. And he gave Billy a special spot for him to come out front and dance and sing a song. And it just blew my mind. You know, the dynamics of that band, the sound of the horns and the, you know, the guitars and the Ray's piano and the beautiful Ray Letts singing and Billy's organ. It was just, for me as a young aspiring piano player, it was just mind boggling. So when I left that arena, my thought was, you know what? I think I found what I want to do for my life's work. I don't, you know, don't really want to be a doctor, a lawyer, or an automobile salesman, but I think I might could pursue a career as a musician. If I could be in a band, not necessarily a band that sounds like Ray Charles, but to be in a band that can move people the way he just moved me. That was the goal.
And it happened. And you learned piano, I think. Was it your mom who taught you?
Yeah, mom was not a professional, not a teacher, but she played for family enjoyment and she was pretty good, you know, and I was the baby of the family. So oftentimes she was basically a housewife, right? And so she would have duties to do and she would show me little simple things on the piano. And as a form of babysitting, occasionally she would say, well, Chuck, I got to go do this or I got to go do that. Why don't you just sit here and you can work on something I showed you or just make something up. It doesn't matter. Just have fun, you know. So it was always one of the other things mom did for me, I will forever grateful for was, and you have to understand you're talking to a 6-7 year old child, but she would say, well, Chuck, what would it sound like if there was a big thunderstorm outside and I'd rumble down on the low end of the piano and do lightning strikes up on the high end? What would it sound like if you hit a home run or made a big play with your little sports team, you know? Oh man, that, you know, hit something happy and heavy. And so she taught me to think about music in terms of feelings, emotions, colors, and not just notes and chords, you know?
Amazing story, Chuck. And from those teachings of your mom, Frances, you end up a number of years later, and not that many years, playing on a great, great gold record, Don't Take Her, She's All I Got.
By Freddie North. I was beginning to get a little bit of mainly demo work around the Muscle Shoals area. Now, what would happen would be you'd have, say, an R&B songwriter, and he's got 5-6 songs, and he wants to do demos of them so that he can take them to, you know, Sam and Dave, or take them to Aretha Franklin or whoever, and try to get the song recorded by these other artists. And so we got paid, I think it was like $25 a day to do these demo sessions, but it was proving grounds, right? You know, it was getting our feet wet, learning the recording process and so forth. So during that period of time, occasionally you'd get a real recording session. And this one came up. They needed an organ player for this song. And it was a pretty cool R&B song. Oddly enough, years, maybe 3-4 years later, Johnny Paycheck had a hit, a country version of Don't Take Her, She's All I've Got. But we did the R&B version. And lo and behold, it was like a regional hit, you know, and that was another thing that set me on fire. I mean, I could turn on radio and hear that song and hear my organ on it. I could hold the record up and look at it, and my name wasn't on it, but I knew that my sound was in the grooves of those records. And boy, it was so exciting. And so it just made me want to do more, you know. And you know, the fact again that it had a degree of success made me think, wow, you know, this can be done. You can do this. You got to have a good song. You got to have some good players and singers, but you can do this. You can make it work. You can be successful.
Amazing. It sounds like you had sort of three forms of education, your formal schooling, working in and around Muscle Shoals, and then most important in retrospect, the college education you got playing with Dr. John.
Oh, Mac. Mac, oh my, I owe so much to Mac Rebenack. My goodness, what a great legacy he has left all of us. But what happened was, I had been playing, I had found my way through Macon, Georgia, to Macon, Georgia, and I found my way to Capricorn Records and started moving up the ladder very slowly. I had been on tour with a guy named Alex Taylor, who was one of the famous Taylor clans. He was James Taylor's elder brother. Alex had two records on Capricorn, and we became his touring band, and we actually did the second record with him. And that tenure lasted about 2 years, maybe. And then Alex had a falling out with the record label, and he decided he didn't want to tour. He didn't want to make them to make any money off of him, so he would stop touring. And at the same time, Phil Walden had signed Dr. John to a management contract, and Mac had just recorded the In the Right Place album, which had the well-known song Right Place, Wrong Time, and he needed a band. And so this serendipitously happened at the same time. Alex quits, Mac gets signed, and we went to audition for Mac in Macon. Mac traveled to Macon and stayed at the Holiday Inn there. And he was a tough taskmaster. We thought we knew what we were doing, the band. We had a good band. We'd been out touring for 2.5 years, and we felt like we had some confidence, But we get in there with Mac, and he's schooling us on what he wants to hear and New Orleans style music. And of course, I know you're familiar with the term second line, which comes from the parades, of course, down in New Orleans, but it mainly refers to a certain feel, a certain, loping rhythmic thing. And so Mac, we would try to play that, and Mac would say, "Oh man, you guys ain't got that second line thing, man. Y'all got to do some more schooling. You better go back and listen to these records." And he was kind of tough on us, but we worked hard, and finally, sure enough, we got the gig. And he was a mentor for me. I was playing mostly Hammond B3 with him, and he was, of course, playing the piano. There was a couple of songs where he would pick up a guitar and I would jump over to the piano then. But it gave me an opportunity to watch and learn from a great New Orleans style piano player that Mac was. And that was really helpful for me. And we became friends. And even after my tenure with him, which was probably 7, 8 months, we remained in touch. He would come see me when I was with the Allman Brothers Band, and he was always very, supportive. And I just love the guy.
Yeah, just a titanic figure in music. And, there's something extraordinary I find about people from all disciplines of the arts, be it musical arts, performing arts, the culinary arts, from New Orleans and Louisiana. All my friends around the world, they all talk about New York and LA and other great cities we have, Chicago, Atlanta, Dallas. But to me, the jewel of America is New Orleans.
Absolutely. I mean, the culture is, just speaks for itself. And not to discount other great New Orleans piano players, Alan Toussaint, of course, the great James Booker, and now you have John Cleary, who is oddly enough an Englishman that migrates to New Orleans and learns that style and just plays it so beautifully. And there's others out there. But I'll give you one Mac story. This was after I had joined the Allman Brothers Band, and Mac was opening a show, and he stayed to hear me play with the Allman Brothers. And we got together in his hotel room afterwards, and he was very complimentary. "Oh, Chucky, I'm just so happy for you, man. It's really great. You're doing a good thing for these boys." And he said, "I got something for you, man. Hang tight here." And he goes over to his desk at the hotel room, and he's fooling around in a bag and gets something. I can't see what he's doing. But he gives me an envelope that has some items in it. It's a small package, if you will. And basically it was juju, right? He had certain good luck charms. And he said, now I want you to find you, get you a little leather bag thing and put all this in there. And you don't have to look at it. You just keep it around you. And I think it might do you some good. And blessings, you know, my career has done very well ever since then. So thank you, Mac, for the good juju.
Oh, my goodness. What a great, great story. So, again, way too much ground to cover everything, but just a couple, you know, to cherry pick. It seems like in very different ways, Chuck, tragedy created opportunity for you twice in very different ways. One was the passing of the great Duane Allman, and the decision of the band to not try to recreate that dual lead guitar sound and do something different. And the second, a name largely lost in history, but an important name in musical history, and that's Ian Stewart. So I'd love to talk about both of them in any order you like.
Well, let's start with Duane. You have to understand that I used to go see the Allman Joys play in Tuscaloosa and in Birmingham. That was the precursor, of course, to the Allman Brothers Band. And even it was the before the Hourglass, which was another version of Greg and Duane. And so, you know, I was absolutely enthralled with the Allman Joys. I thought they were fabulous. They had a great band. They had a great look. Duane had that stage presence. Greg had that amazing voice. And they used to do Beatles covers like Paperback Writer. I mean, all those harmonies on that song, and they would recreate it beautifully. So I was a fan of both Greg and Duane from way, way back when I was 13, 14 years old, watching the Allman Joys. So then fast forward to the Allman Brothers Band. Now you have this really great creative group that are incorporating blues and rock and roll and some jazz into the music. And they're beginning to get popular. First album does okay, second about the same, but they're starting to get recognition. And then they do the Live at the Fillmore East record, which really breaks the band. And it was such a powerful live performance. And the world started to pay attention to the Allman Brothers Band. Well, by this time, I'm in Macon, Georgia. I'm making my way up the ladder, doing some recording sessions, played with this artist and that artist. And all of a sudden, and Duane, by the way, was not only the undisputed leader of the Allman Brothers Band, but he was pretty much the leader of Southern music. Everybody loved Duane. He had done all those records with Aretha Franklin and Wilson Pickett and others. And you could hear his beautiful guitar playing on all those records. He had become a very well-known session player. And now he's got his own band with his brother, with the other great players, Dickie Betts, you know, Barry Oakley, and so forth. And tragedy happens, and he has that motorcycle accident. I think he was 24. I mean, it just seems impossible, but I think that's how old he was. It's just crazy to think he had done all of that by age 24 and then was tragically, he passes away in a motorcycle accident. So I remember where we were. I was in Macon. I was at Johnny Sandlin's house. Johnny Sandlin was a producer for Capricorn Records and a good friend. Some other musicians were around the house at the time. The phone rings. Johnny picks it up. He turns white as a ghost and turns to us and he said, Duane, you know, is in a terrible accident and they don't think he's going to make it. Phone rings about another 45 minutes later. Duane's gone. Huge shock. I mean, of course, to the band, but to all of us, because he was just like so important a figure to all of us. We, you know, regarded him highly, and he had led the way for success in a Southern band, you know. So what happens? Well, you mentioned it. You don't replace Duane Allman. There was rumors, you know, would Jeff Beck come in? Would Eric Clapton? There was names were being thrown around. But the reality was there's nobody that could replace him. He was such a unique player. So what did the band do? They did a very gutsy thing. They went back out as a five-piece band, no replacement. tremendous pressure on Dickie Betts. I mean, Dickie's never played slide before, right? And he's got to learn all these slide guitar parts that Duane was known for. So they go out and they do, it was a significant amount of shows over a not quite a year period. I think it was like 90 shows over a maybe a, you know, 6-7 month period. They come off of that tour emotionally drained, physically drained, and they needed a break. So Greg decides, okay, I want to do a solo record, and while everybody's taking a break, I'll do that. I get the call again from Johnny Sandlin, who Greg has chosen to produce the record. Do you want to play on Greg's record? Yes, please. So we start that process. It's going great. We have a nice set of musicians. The sessions are going well. After a couple of weeks, we would have these jam sessions where the rest of the Allman Brothers would come in, sometimes not all of them, but some of them, and sometimes it would be all of them. And we would just play, pick a key and go, or do a blues song or do an Allman Brothers song. It didn't matter. We would just play. And I'm playing piano with these guys, you know. I'm like, wow, this is cool. You know, I'm 20 years old at the time. And this process goes on maybe 3 weeks. I get a call from the office of Capricorn Records. Phil Walden, the band's manager, and as I mentioned earlier, the founder of Capricorn Records, would like to see you in his office. Oh, Lord, what did I do something wrong? You know, I was a little nervous. I didn't know what this was about. Well, anyway, I go into the office. There's Phil and there's everybody in the band. Pleasantries go around and then the shoe drops. The guys feel like this is really going quite well, and they like your sound along with the songs that they're experimenting with. Would you like to join the Allman Brothers band? And so I think we know the answer that I gave. And as soon as we finished Greg's record, we started recording the Brothers and Sisters record that had Ramblin' Man and Jessica, Come and Go Blues, Jelly Jelly, and all of those songs. And it was quite a big step for a kid from Alabama, but I tried to keep my head screwed on straight and focus on the music. That was my thought the whole time through. Just try to contribute, try to do good. And Chuck, don't screw it up.
Well, you sure didn't. And it was a great run. Not only about 3 or 4 years, I guess.
Yeah, it was 4 years, four plus a little bit.
And then you, with some of the members, launch your own band, fronting a band for the first time, and had a great, great run. Really, I think, really beloved and appreciated by people that really know music, and that was Sea Level.
Yes, indeed. The way that started was while we were still with the Allman Brothers band, occasionally J-Mo, one of the drummers, would play these jazz records for some of us that were, you know, not only in the Allman Brothers, but that were just friends coming through. So Miles Davis and Chick Corea, Herbie Hancock, John Coltrane, all these records we'd be listening to. And we could never, you know, play jazz music like that, but we started letting our jam sessions go into that realm a little bit and try to make things interesting. And we developed a little trio that was J-Mo and Lamar Williams and myself. And we would just practice at J-Mo's house. And then sometimes if somebody had a party and there was equipment set up, we'd play at that and just experiment and having fun. Well, when the breakup of the Allman Brothers occurred, the three of us said, look, we can go on our merry way, or we could try to do something with this concept. I felt like we needed a fourth member that I wasn't comfortable just have as a trio. So so I called my old friend Jimmy Knowles, who worked with me with Dr. John and with Alex Taylor. Jimmy flew down from Washington, D.C. area, played with us. It was immediately apparent that this was going to work. So that's how Sea Level was formed. And we got Stuart Levine to produce the first couple of records, first three records, I guess it was. The reason we wanted Stu was because he had produced all those wonderful Crusaders records. Do you remember the Jazz Crusaders? And then they eventually dropped the jazz and they were just the Crusaders. instrumental band. And we love those records. And that was kind of the direction we wanted to take the rock and roll aspect of the Southern soul aspect of what we were doing. So, you know, we did respectable. We were selling 250, 300,000 records a pop. Eventually expanded the band with my good friend, Randall Bramlett, who's still this amazing talent from the South. For your listeners that don't know Randall Bramlett, look him up. He is one of the best singer-songwriters on the earth today. He's a very prolific songwriter and just beautiful, beautiful work. And he and I still work together. But you know, as I said, we were selling 250, 300,000 a pop. We had a good 5-year run of it. We never reached the status of an Allman Brothers band, but we got to where we were playing nice theaters, sometimes opening up for people like Jefferson Starship or whatnot. And we had a lot of fun with it. So it was a good run.
Great, great, great band. And, you know, as we start to wrap now and bring us up to the present, but in this case, the present starts in the early 80s. I mean, you've worked with everybody, Chuck, from Eric Clapton, who you mentioned, to incredible work. I love how Pat describes your role with Drops of Jupiter for Train as so seminal to the success of that band and that song. Icons like George Harrison, great, great other players like Government Mule and your old buddy Warren Haynes and Derek Trucks, incredible talents, on and on and on. The Fabulous Thunderbirds, who you mentioned earlier. But it was that other name I want to go back to, and Ian Stewart, a name that is largely lost in history. And tell that story. I know initially it didn't work out, and then all of a sudden it did work out. And all of a sudden now, for you know over 40 years, you've been really a Rolling Stone. And not a lot of people can say that.
Well, it has been quite the journey, I'll tell you. You know, when I got the gig, and it really was mainly because of Ian Stewart, that I got the gig. But when it happened, I thought to myself, oh my heavens, I'm playing with the Rolling Stones. This is absolutely unbelievable. I mean, this is crazy. Wouldn't it be great if I could get 3, maybe 4 or 5 years out of this thing? And here we are 42 years later, and it's it's still, I pinch myself and still boggles my mind. But let's talk about Stu. Stu started the Rolling Stones. He and I guess it was Brian Jones started a little blues thing. I think there was an ad in the paper saying, hey, anybody interested in playing the blues, come to this address. And they had some equipment set up. And I guess Brian was one of the people that showed up. And there were others, you know, the names that floating around. I don't know if maybe John Mayall or, you know, some English people that were musicians that were interested in playing the blues. And then eventually Mick and Keith come around. And of course, they're managed at the time by Andrew Lug Oldham. And to cut to the chase, he felt like, hey, 6 members is too many, and Stu doesn't quite look the part of a Rolling Stone. And so they gently pushed Stu to the side, asking him, you know, and look, we don't want to fire you necessarily, but we don't want you in the pictures. You can play on the records. And, you know, that I'm sure there were some hurt feelings there, but Stu took it quite well. He didn't want to go away. He thought the boys had talent and were doing something. So he became a confidant, a logistician. In the early days, he was a guy that drove the van, right? You know, to take the band to those early tours and whatnot. And he was such an interesting character. Stu loved golf. That was his big thing, you know. And so at one point, the band in the early days found themselves, you know, why are we staying out in the middle of nowhere and we got to drive 40 miles to get to this club that we're playing? Because there was a golf course there that Stu wanted to play because he booked all the hotels as well in those early days. Well, anyway, he was a fabulous stylist, especially in boogie-woogie style piano playing. You know, I had studied the blues and had become, you know, somewhat knowledgeable in blues piano playing by the time that the Stones asked me to audition. But I wasn't that familiar with boogie woogie, you know, the real boogie woogie. And Stu was an expert at it. And we became friends immediately. He was the guy that picked me up at the airport when I auditioned, drove me to the facility where we played. We became quick friends, and he pushed for me to be in the band. I didn't get, as you mentioned earlier, I didn't get that tour, which was 1981. I got the 1982 tour, which was the European tour that was promoting the Tattoo U record. But for instance, Stu, while I did get the gig and we would be in London, you're not staying in a hotel. You're staying with me. I've got two nice grand pianos and a very large record collection. And so we would listen to these boogie woogie records. He taught me a lot about left hand independent playing, that style of piano playing. And, you know, we were really, really close. I joined in 82. There was no touring after that. You know, we did that European tour. The next thing we did was a record in 1983, and then another one in 1985. And that's when Stu passed away. I think it was 85. Devastating blow to all of us. You know, he was just a great, great friend, a mentor, and taught me so much. So I'm forever grateful to Ian Stewart. And thankfully, you know, there's still some recordings that you can hear him play on.
Yeah, I was very glad we went to see you and the band on your Hackney Diamonds tour in Cleveland. And we went purposefully because my wife and I had never been to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And we loved it. And I was very glad that, of course, the Stones are very prominent in the museum, and that they gave Brian Jones and Ian Stewart their due, which is well earned.
Yeah, yeah. That was the right thing to do for sure. But Stu, I'll just give you a couple of quick things. When I got the gig, I said, Stu, I'm so happy to be here, but why isn't Nicky Hopkins here? You know, why isn't Billy Preston here? And he said, well, with Nicky, he had health issues and the band was always afraid that, you know, that he couldn't make a gig and they would be without him for a portion of the tour. And with Billy, he said Billy got a little headstrong and, you know, wanted to be up front dancing with Mick and showing off a little bit, and he just got to be too much. And so the guys, you know, decided to let him go. And so that gave me some insight as to what my role was with the band, right? You know, and that was very helpful. And the other thing about Stu was, he would say things like, don't like slow songs, they're boring. And don't like minor chords, it sounds Chinese. And so if it was a ballad or it had minor chords, I got to play the piano. You know, if it was a rocker, Stu wanted to play the piano.
Oh, fantastic stuff. And over those 42 years, incredible. And I've been lucky enough to see the band many, many, many times. Including what was supposed to be when there was the 50th anniversary. They did a couple shows. I'm sure you were on stage at the O2, and then they did a couple in New York, and that was supposed to be it. And here we are a dozen years later, more, and still going. The last tour, Chuck, the band sounded better than ever.
Thank you for that. And I have to agree. I really do. I think maybe it has something to do with the fact that we are in this particular phase of life and we realize how precious this is, how, you know, fortunate we are that we get to do this music, that we get to play it, that the people want to come and see it, and that we can put on a show that's hopefully deserving of some accolades. And it's fun, you know, it's addictive, and we enjoy it. So I don't know. Is it over with? I don't think so. I think we could go on next year. I know the band has some more songs that for Hackney Diamonds that they didn't use that they could work on. Might be another record. I don't know. And, you know, there could be other tours. So I certainly hope so. And everybody wants to. I think everybody's still enjoying it. Everybody wants to go. And they don't want to let the fans down. You know, as long as the fans want to come, I think the band wants to play.
You know, there's something very admirable. I had and you're the youngster of the band at 72. I just had a milestone birthday. I turned 60. And when it was my turn to say something at a lovely dinner, my wife threw for me, I said the trait that I enjoy the most and value the most as I looked around who was there is that of longevity. Mm. And that marks your career, Chuck. It marks the Stones' career. I mean, Daryl's been in the band how many years now?
Since 94, the Voodoo Lounge record.
And you go back, and sadly, we lost Charlie Watts. Like we didn't miss a beat with Steve Jordan, but that had to be very meaningful for you to get to work and know Charlie all those years, who was the quietest of them all, but really the steady rock of the band.
Oh, what a blessing to know Charlie and to play with him all those years. Just phenomenal. And his personality, his, you know, way of doing things is a little quirky, but so beautiful. A more beautiful human being never walked the face of the earth than Charlie Watts.
Fantastic. Well, Chuck, I can't thank you enough for doing this. It was such a joy to talk to you, and your passion in everything you do comes right through the screen, and many, many years of health and success ahead of you. I don't know what to say to wrap this. I'm really just without speech, but it's been a privilege to get this time with you and to have you on Great Minds.
Well, listen, it was an honor to be asked, and you know, I love your podcast. It's so interesting, and I'm just flattered that you would ask me to be on it, and really enjoyed it. Let's do it again sometime.
You bet. Thank you, Chuck.
Okay, all the best.